Welcome to the Upland Nation podcast. I'm Scott Linden, your host. Glad you could join me. We'll be taking another informative adventure into the uplands and going afield a little bit as well. We're going back to the Pheasant Fest at Sioux Falls, South Dakota. My guest this week, Carl Gunzer of Purina. This guy knows his stuff. He's a dog trainer, as well as a guy who hangs with all the nutritional experts at that company. We'll be talking about all those things, nutrition, how it relates to performance, some tricks and tips that he and I have devised over the years, dog training advice, as well as how to fuel a dog on a long hunt, taking care of their feet as well, why high fat is best, and how to hydrate your working dog. Our Facebook question from you to me this week is how to keep a flushing dog close. That'll be our Handle It segment this week. I'll have one tip. That's about all I got in me when it comes to flushing dogs. And maybe I'll even share some of your advice there. And then finally, we'll talk about the most important command in the field. What you all think it is and why. Now hang on. There's a bit of debate here. Get ready for that. All made possible by Sage and Breaker, Pointer Shotguns, Mid-Valley Clays, TruLock Choke Tubes, MidwayUSA.com, Purina Pro Plan Sport, LandTrust.com, ESPAmerica.com, and Hi-Viz Shooting Systems. Well, I am getting out regularly, not as frequently as I like, but getting out regularly to practice my shooting. Lucky enough to have a de facto shooting range not too far from our place on public land. Official in that it's, Forest Service approved, if you want to call it that. The joy of this place, it's a big cinder pit is what it is. Out here we have miniature volcanoes that are made up mainly of little chunks of lava that quite often get mined, in the old days, would get mined to use in place of sand on the roads. So we got a half. In fact, I'm looking out the window now at my half cinder cone. Can't shoot there, but we can shoot a couple miles south of here. And the joy of that cinder pit, that cinder cone, is they left big piles of cinders. So I'm working on being on the top of those piles, shooting down at targets, like on a chucker hunt. Man, it's hard, but at least I have a place to do it. You start going up and practicing at every, you go up a couple feet, shoot four targets. You go up another step, shoot four more targets. If you're missing, you go back down a step, so on and so forth. That's my goal, is to start hitting those low going away targets just a little bit better. And all that with a 28 gauge, which makes it just a little bit more challenging. Whips around like a rodeo queen as she going through the grand entry. So that's my goal, and that's what I'm working on these days. You are working on training in many respects, and so I thought, like me, I'd ask you what you all believed is the most important command in the field. And it comes up about 50-50 or 100-100. Most of your responses, and there was a whole bunch of them on Facebook in particular, are along the lines of some kind of a recall, whether it's come or here or whatever, and then some sort of a whoa. Arkady Pizarevsky calls it stand still. Stand, whoa, sit, or down. Something that gets that dog to stop moving. And I get all that, and we won't go into the debate, but I will step on the edge of the weeds and go in that far and suggest, of the two, I still like the recall better. They're both safety-oriented, absolutely safety-oriented. But if you can get your dog to stop in the middle of the highway, then you got to get him to move again. So instead, maybe it is simply get him to come back to me while he's still moving. Just a thought, Thought I'd plant that there. James Brigham touches on that. Whoa! Followed up with, here. Yeah, absolutely. Jor Fu says, dog retrieval at any moment. And then he goes on and suggests whether I'm saying it or I'm beeping or toning him on his collar, it doesn't matter. Okay, all Andy McCormick. First, I thought it was a typo, Andy. Here, heel. Yeah, both good. And yeah, boy, I had to use those last week. Long story I won't bore you with, but out at that other cinder pit. No, I don't take my dog when I'm target shooting. Do you? Don Williams has an interesting take on this. The command you give is the most important at that time and place. You must have obedience in the field, and it starts at home. Amen to that, Don. You're absolutely right. Let's see here. Lance Larson, woe and recall. Yeah, both can mean the safety of your dog in various situations. And there, that's a good point too, Lance. Yeah. So sometimes it is woe, sometimes it is here. And that works differently in different situations. Stop, recall, definitely recall. Prairie Rose Gun Dog says hup or anything with the same meaning. Yeah, on a spaniel, hup. Yeah, can't forget you folks. In fact, I'll be talking more about you folks and what little I know about that world that I stole from somebody else later on in the program. Thank you all. Great stuff. Excellent advice. Sure appreciate it. And always fascinating to see what you're thinking about that sort of thing. So keep up the good work. If you're not going to the Wing Shooting USA or the Upland Nation Facebook pages on a periodic basis, there's always something there for you. Usually I'm asking for your thoughts, your suggestions, your ideas. And in fact, we'll be talking about that in the future too. So thank you all. And thank you, Sage and Breaker Gun Care Products, for bringing us that segment of the show. Also, ProPlanSport.com is where you learn all about ProPlan Sport dog food from Purina for active, hardworking dogs like ours. Particularly rich in omega-3 fatty acids and glucosamine to help support joint health and mobility during training and throughout their life. Yeah, Flick is going on 7 years old. In June, he'll turn 7. And I'm watching him get up at the end of the day. He's laying on the floor watching TV, and he gets up, and he's got a little bit of a hitch in his get-along once in a while. Nothing serious, and I'm sure it's just the fact that he worked hard that day, but I'm staying on top of that stuff with a great food that has glucosamine. That is ProPlan Sport. Learn more about all the formulations at ProPlanSport.com. And working on a video for Hi-Vis Sites that brought up an interesting thought for you, and that is, yeah, depending on how you're shooting, you do look at the bead on the end of your shotgun muzzle, or you don't. But you do. It may be subliminal, it may be subconscious, but you got to create a relationship between the muzzle and the target. Otherwise, you'd miss everything, or you'd hit everything just by sheer luck. The joy of these Hi-Vis sights and their light pipes is that you don't have to think about the muzzle, the bead, if you will, the end of your gun, because it's visible enough in your subconscious. Then you can put all of your focus, pardon the pun, literally, on the bird, or the clay target for that matter. The joy of these interlocking light pipe systems is you can change the color, change the shape. You'll never lose the bead while you're tracking the target. You know what that means to me? Boom. Fetch. Learn more at HiVizSights.com. HiVizSights.com. Welcome back to the Josh, where are we? It is the umpteenth annual Pheasant Fest and Quail Classic from Sioux Falls, South Dakota, on the floor in the Pointer Shotguns booth with a guy who knows more about dogs. He's forgotten more about dogs than I'll ever know. Carl Gunzer with Purina. He's the director of this sporting dog group. So you're at a lot of these events, Carl, and welcome to the Upland Nation podcast. What's the top line for this event for you? What are you seeing, learning? What surprised
Man,
you so far?
That's a good question. So, we love this event because it's so dog-centric.
Yeah.
And not only do people bring their dogs, there's a lot of dogs here from all the different organizations like, NAVDA and the American Brittany Club and on, And so that's what makes it such a perfect fit for Purina.
Oh, yeah.
A couple of things that I've seen this year more and more of, hearing protection is one thing.
Yeah.
And I wish I saw more hearing protection booths, 20 years ago when I could hear, because now I can't hear, and I wish I had taken care of my ears. But
What?
Yeah, exactly.
I'm sorry, I couldn't resist.
But I guess that's one thing I've noticed this year. More of, and I think is good for the industry.
Yeah.
And frankly, from a dog food perspective, I got to say, I see more and more dog food companies every year, and not surprised, but there is a lot of new companies in the dog food space.
You know, you're absolutely right. I run into these guys quite often at events like this, and it's the same guys but a different logo on their shirt.
Right.
And God bless them. They're all good guys, and they all have the right objectives in mind.
Absolutely.
And that's why everybody's working so hard at it. And we'll get back to the nutrition side in a few minutes. But, let's first talk about dogs and what you're seeing out there in the way of same thing. You go to an event, you see a lot of hearing protection, or you see whatever it is. Yep. You go to a lot of dog events. You mentioned some of the breeds. I'm seeing a lot of the less common breeds.
Yeah,
they're becoming less common.
Yeah, exactly. Sesky Fusex and Deutsch Longhairs and all that. And I think it's good to see different breeding programs bringing up different dogs for filling different niches, and a lot of them are a lot the same too, though. But when you get into the German dogs and the Deutsch Drathars and the German Wirehairs, and they're all very similar backgrounded but then bred for slightly different purposes, but there's not a whole lot of not as much difference between all of them as I think many people would have you believe.
Yeah, we're all after the same thing. When all is said and done, we want the dogs to do much the same thing, and we want them to do it in the way that breed might do it. I was at the Epagnol-Breton conclave a few months ago, and they love their dogs to find birds. Yeah, okay, don't we all?
Yeah.
But in a certain way, with a little bit of style and a little bit of flair that's slightly different than a short hair.
Yep.
And then we go to Labradors, and that's your breed.
Yes. Yep.
Tell me a little bit about how you got into the dog world in general.
Yeah. Boy, I don't know that. How long is this podcast? I don't think there's a long enough deal. But, honestly, I started playing and messing around with training dogs when I was 13. And my dad had bought a puppy. We'd had a dog die and bought a puppy. And the deal was like, hey, I'll get this puppy, but you need to train it. So we bought the dog and bought me this book by Bill Tarrant. Hey, Pup, fetch it up. And I went through page by page and read. And then so that was kind of my first real hunting dog that became a steady, decent hunting retriever, as in my teens. And then I went to college and always kept a dog through college. And started a career, but always had a dog and always started competing and just sort of doing hunt tests and then field trials and doors just sort of opened up, and I quit my real job and started training dogs.
Which presumes that training dogs is an unreal job. but everybody probably looks at you and says, "Oh, wow, you get to play with dogs all day. That's not a job." Find a job you love, you'll never work a day in your life. Well, it's not all about that. It's not beer and Skittles.
That's right. It sounds great, and that is the right idea. I love what I do for Purina, but coming to these events like this is the ice cream. It's not it's not the spinach.
Yeah. absolutely. So. Well, when you were training hard, what are some of the lessons you learned that have stuck with you that we might want to apply for our own dog training or dog care?
Yep. That's a good question. I think one of the first things is dogs like steady leadership, just like all of us. And I see that now more that I'm not training dogs than when I was training dogs. But, you know, how you probably don't have a boss now, and but, you know, how nice it is when you have a boss that has constant realistic expectations that you know how to meet them, you know. And for the dogs, it's a little different. It's not maybe a game plan or a performance development plan, but it's like, oh, we're going to eat at the same time every day. We're going to exercise at the same time. We're going to get let out at the same time. And so they have stability in their life, which leads to kind of consistent expectations. And then as a trainer, by being consistent and always being fair, that's where I think you gain that great relationship with the dog. And I think it takes a while to get to that point in life, you know?
Yeah, but you got to live it.
Yes.
I mean, I like the word fair. I've used it a lot. And I think that's one thing that a lot of people never consider when they're relating to an animal.
Yes.
But animals can figure things out a lot better than we think they can.
They have no objectives, right?
Yeah.
That's whatever, you know, when you meet a person, you don't know if they have a hidden objective or animal, they're just right there.
Yeah.
It's input, output. They're, you know, people say my dog lied to me or, you know, he screwed me or whatever. No, he didn't. You didn't read it. You didn't recognize it. He's just being a dog.
Yeah. You also mentioned something else that I'm intrigued by, and that is the idea that dogs like that consistency.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not just the time of day when they're fed or let out, or it's in how you train. Can you give me an example of how that might apply to, most of us amateur dog trainers?
Well, I think one of the hard pieces is for an amateur is that they have a job and you have to do things and your schedule becomes less flexible depending on your career and what you're doing. And so you have to set aside time for the dog to try and do something. And, you know, if there's a big project or something going on at work or you have to travel, you know, you might be away and you can't be as consistent in your training. I think that's really one of the greatest benefits that professionals have is that they're not setting aside time to train. They are setting aside time to work, and that's their training, you know. So I think the more an amateur can, even if it's breaking at lunch, you know, a lot of people work from home now. It's busy. If you can take a half an hour every day at lunch and go train or do something like that, it gives you the mental break. It gives the dog the training it needs. I was listening to Rick Smith up on stage today, and, you know, he was talking about how he's working a dog up there for a half an hour, but if ideally he would be working it for 10 minutes and do it two or three times a day. And I think that's a really good point. You know, people have busy schedules and they can't set aside an hour to go train, but you can train in 5 or 10 minutes just doing a couple drills in the house that can be fun for you or the dog.
And, you know, I'm glad you said that because I've been a big believer in this idea that you can train on the commercial breaks during a football game.
Yeah.
And sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't, but you got to try that. You got to have the mindset that says, yeah, I really do need to do it several times a day.
Yep. Yep.
What about the poor schmuck who only gets the weekends? You know, he's got three children, he's got a wife, maybe he's working two jobs.
Yep.
So it's a Saturday and Sunday thing. Should he just find a new owner for that dog? Or is there any way he can actually turn that dog into a bird dog?
Yep. Absolutely, absolutely. You know, it was funny, I did a deal with DU not long ago working on an article they're writing, and it is just about that, and it's coming out. And, you know, they're a gal that won the National Retriever Championship, has a full-time job.
Yeah.
This is an amateur, and she won 2 years ago, and she basically trains on weekends.
Yeah.
Now, during the week, you know, she'll kind of train at home, not doing the big, you know, retrieving or running the dog in the field, but just obedience around the house. Learn to sit before you open the dog. Do little stuff in the house with place boards or whatever. Just engaging, keeping the dog thinking and partnering. Mm-hmm. And then on the weekends, you know, put in a bigger effort and go train. And I absolutely think people can do it.
I had a probably the shining example of that a while back. He's going on six, but Flick, my wire hair, still needs work, and steadiness is one of the things I'm working on. And, you know, I'm doing it my way, and one way to do it is he understands that, yes, instinctive part of that drill, and then the obedience part of that drill. And I gave him a whoa in the hallway, going down the hallway. And then the two cats walked past and started fighting right in front of him.
Right.
His front end went up, it went back down, and it did not move.
Awesome.
Through the whole cat fight.
Yep.
So I'm pretty proud of him and his owner, who's doing a better job.
Yeah. Well, you know, people always ask about the perfect dog, and there's no, just like there's no perfect person, there is no perfect dog. And when you have a person and a dog, that just compounds the imperfection. So, I think that's, you know, Mike Lardy always said you own what you condone. And, you know, I think you sort of pick your fights. Don't expect perfection, but don't allow the things that really you don't want to allow. So if your bugaboo is steadiness, well, then work on it. You know, if your other thing is getting along with dogs or ranging too far or whatever it is, you know, pick your battles, make an effort, but don't expect perfection.
Yeah. You know, so my listeners are particularly interested in doing certain things this off season, and high on that list is becoming a better retriever. Now, for the most part, it's called the Upland Nation podcast, so you can imagine that there aren't a lot of duck dogs owners listening.
Right.
But we expect all of our pointing breeds to retrieve most of the time.
Yep.
Coming from the Labrador world and the retriever world to a degree, and I know you're working with everybody now, we'll get to that. But, Carl, do you have any advice for us in terms of helping our dog become a better retriever?
I would say probably the biggest thing is looking for lines that tend to have good retrieving parents and all that. You know, there's, you know, if you start, let's say you go with the pointers, you know, like English pointers, they don't focus a lot on retrieving.
Yeah.
But I promise you, and I raised an English pointer from a 8-week-old puppy and made it a Nassar dog, and that dog retrieved fine. And then a lot of the time, I trained it and treated it like a retriever.
Sure.
I would throw stuff for it and have it retrieve and all, like a lot of people, the versatile dogs do, obviously. And this pointer did fine, and he learned to retrieve. It'll never be his strength, but they can do it. And I think the things that aren't their strength, I think oftentimes we want to move to force too quickly.
Uh-huh.
And I kind of think if that's not their strength, let's try and encourage it more and bring that behavior out than trying to force them to do something they don't really want to do. And I'm not saying that I don't believe in trained retrieves and force fetching and all that. I absolutely do. But I think that never, a force fetch never made a dog like to retrieve.
Yeah.
It made them retrieve or taught them to retrieve, but it didn't make them like to do it.
Yeah.
And I would prefer to teach them to like to do it first, and then once you've built that, that it can be a good thing and enjoyable, then you can start to reinforce it a little bit.
Yeah, you know, maybe they ought to call it reinforce.
Right.
Breaking.
Yes.
You know,
yes. Yeah.
Get the easy stuff done.
Yep.
Lay the foundation, or get the pieces in various places working, and then pinch the ear for step three.
Right.
Or whatever.
Yep.
Yeah. Ronnie and Susanna were in earlier, and they talked about much the same thing in a slightly different way, and I thought it was a way we've never really thought about it before. Can you think about anything else in the retrieving world that we pointing breed owners neglect or ought to work on more?
Mine will not be about like teaching sit or not teaching sit, but I think, you know, there are a lot of ways to force fetch a dog that, or to teach a dog to fetch without pressure and that. And, you know, a lot of the sort of what you'd call clicker training, you know, is the term 10 years ago or whatever, but a positive marker is maybe the way people are referring to it more now. But, you know, there are a lot of obedience dog trainers out there that are teaching, you know, Whippets and Greyhounds and, you know, all these different breeds that have zero retrieve drive bred into them, and they're teaching them to retrieve. And it's done through a positive marker, teaching a dog, you know, to understand a positive reinforcement and then teaching the hold conditioning and all that through that. And I think I'm seeing more people in the bird dog world and the retriever world start accepting these obedience training methods.
Yeah.
And I think are seeing some real positive results instead of trying to force what people consider maybe a stubborn dog is like, hey, make it the dog's idea, and then once it becomes their idea, they're a lot more likely to do it and perform the command.
And you've been there. You've been to, say, AKC events that yes. are obedience trials.
Yep.
They're picking
yep.
stuff up and bringing
Absolutely.
It back.
Cheerfully. So, yeah. With glee. Yep.
And it could be a Clumber Spaniel, for
yeah,
that matter.
Exactly right.
So it can be done in various ways. And that you know, I keep coming back to an analogy my friend Bob Ferris gave me for pointing. You want a steady dog, the first thing you do is realize the point. When he hits the scent cone, he points because it's instinctive. But then here comes the obedience component.
Yep.
He's got to stay still.
Right.
That's when you got to actually do the real training.
Yep.
And there's bits and pieces of that on the retrieving side as well. Well, a good friend of mine, Jeff Funky, who I saw earlier today, reminded me that most self-respecting dogs will run out and go pick up a bird that died on the wing or they saw in the distance that was
yep.
already dead.
Yep.
Roadkill, for that matter. The key is, okay, once they do that, how do we get them back?
Yeah.
So so that becomes the obedience challenge, I guess.
Yep.
And I'm not telling you anything you don't know. It's probably wrong, but it seems to make sense when you think about it that way.
100%.
As opposed to talking to somebody earlier today who said, yeah, my dad, he'd just take a dog out, and the first bird they got up, he'd kill it, and if the dog didn't retrieve it,
he'd get another dog. Well, that's one strategy.
Yeah, I guess, yeah. We're going to talk about performance and nutrition a lot, but let's start before the break with that and get everybody, whet everybody's appetite.
There you go.
There's a right and a wrong way to feed a dog on a hunting day. We all just disagree on which is which.
Yeah.
You know, as you've heard before, put two dog trainers in a room and you'll get three opinions.
Yeah.
But do you have any recommendations for strategic feeding on a hunt day?
100%. So the biggest thing I like to do is not have food or bulk in the dog's stomach.
Yeah.
So I don't like to feed in the morning, if at all possible, and we'll talk about some exceptions to that. But in the easy first answer is, you know, once a day in the evening after the hunt, the dog's had time to cool down. And then a couple little additions is I like to float their food, so I'll yeah. add water just like you might add milk to your cereal.
Mm-hmm.
It just helps a little more hydration. It's not trying to draw water out of the dog's body when it's
yeah.
in the stomach. And then make sure they have free access to water and all that a couple hours
yeah.
afterwards.
Yeah.
That's sort of the first easy answer. It gets more complicated for people that hunt on like week-long hunting
yeah.
trips where
yeah.
there's huge nutritional needs. And, you know, a Labrador could need anywhere between 1,200 calories and 12,000 calories.
Yeah.
And as you can imagine, that's, you know, the difference between 3/4 of a cup and like, you know, 8 cups of food or 10 cups of food, or they can't even eat enough, right?
Yeah,
and in those
yeah.
cases, you might have to break down some meals, or it's sort of planned wasting. You know, over that week, they're going to lose weight over that week and you're okay with it. You come into that week a little heavy.
Yeah.
And then by the end, you hope they're doing okay. And then you give them a little break or time off to try and manage through the season. But there are cases where people feed twice a day just because of the large volume. And in those cases, I really think it's okay, but give them at least a couple hours after that first meal. 3 or 4 is better.
Yeah.
And make that morning meal smaller. It'll probably still end up with a little diarrhea. You know, if there's food in that intestinal tract and they're running, and I don't care what food, you know, it's not hard to get diarrhea.
Well, that's better than some of the other things that could happen. I used to use a demonstration. I'd take my truck keys. I'd take a clean sock.
Yep.
Unless I didn't have any, then I'd use a dirty sock. I'd drop those keys into that sock, and I'd hold the sock with both hands in front of me. The keys drop to the heel of the sock.
Okay.
Just like the food. That's the belly.
Yep.
That's
yep.
the stomach.
Yep.
And then I bounce that sock around with both hands, and eventually it twirls.
Mm-hmm.
And we got
mm-hmm.
another problem.
Yeah.
Have you seen any? I've seen science in both ways. Have you guys at Purina, who do all the research for us, by the
yep.
way, thank you.
Yep.
Have you seen any correlation there?
I think there's some anecdotal evidence
yeah.
of that. you know, and there's a lot of things to worry about. Certainly running with food in the belly and all that is not good, especially if it's a large quantity. And you can even worry a little bit about water. A dog can tank up with water. Some dogs are big water drinkers, and that's not going to just flow right out the belly either. That's going to take some time to digest and absorb. So 100%, I don't like them too active. And I think, you know, a lot of what we've used as sort of the perfect research was the sled dogs.
Yeah.
And try and figure out, okay, what was the best strategy if you wanted to run a sled race or run a sled dog competition? And they would feed their dogs 24 hours before they work. They wanted the whole, not just the belly, but the small intestine and the large intestine emptied out.
Yeah.
Now, that only works on day one, right? Because, you know, after that, now you've got to try, you hope you've got a 12-hour window for digestion. But what people need to remember is that food is not bioavailable in the stomach. It's not bioavailable in the gut. It's the nutrients that go into the muscles that are being burned. So it's the fat and all that that's stored in the muscles that are running. So it doesn't really do you any good to put food in their stomach.
Yeah.
And that's not useful energy.
Well, hold that thought. We're going to take a quick break here from the floor of the Pheasant Fest and Quail Classic in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. That's Carl Gunzer with Purina. I'm Scott Linden. This is the Upland Nation. We'll be back in just a moment. We have more with Carl Gunzer from the floor of the National Pheasant Fest and Quail Classic coming up in the second half of the show, as well as our road... not our road trip. This week, we're doing a Handle It segment, and we're talking about keeping our flushing dogs within gun range, whatever that means to you, and whatever that means to you and me, and so on and so forth. So stay right here after these brief messages from LandTrust.com, where you get outdoors without the crowds. Man, was that nice on my last Montana trip. Yeah, we had the whole place to ourselves, and you can too. You could discover exclusive access on private land for your next outdoor experience. No stress, just you and your dog, maybe a good friend or two, enjoying your time on a beautiful piece of private ground. By the day, multiple days, you name it. Some lodging, some camping, a little bit of everything. Shop around at LandTrust.com. Open a free account and try it for yourself. If you like what you see, then book it, just like a VRBO or an Airbnb. Learn more at LandTrust.com. TrueLockChokes.com is my source. If I want to shoot better real fast, I just put in a TrueLock choke. They're consistently better. They make their chokes primarily from 17-04 stainless steel bar stock. It resists rust, corrosion. They're heat treated to a high strength level that resists wear and choke creep. You know what I mean by that? When they start coming unscrewed, talk about embarrassing. Yeah. And there are some real convenient aspects about what they do with their tubes as well. For example, on the head and on the body, the name of the specific construction. So no matter where it is, you can tell what it is. Sign up for email notifications on sales and other promotions. They've always got something going on at TrueLockChokes.com. Spell it T... Start that again. Spell it T-R-U. L-O-C-K Chokes.com. We're back. We're in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. What a logical place to have a pheasant fest, let alone a quail classic. That's Carl Gunzer on your left speaker. I'm Scott Linden on your right speaker. This is the Upland Nation podcast. And Carl, we were talking about feeding, strategic feeding.
Yep.
And you've alluded a couple times to the bugaboo for a lot of us, whether it's a two-day hunt or a four-day or a six-day hunt.
Yep.
It's the second and the third and the fourth days when we start seeing, you described it as planned or strategic wasting, if you will.
Yeah.
You know, you can't jam enough calories into a dog.
Right.
If you're careful about how you feed. What can a guy do about that? Because it does translate to performance.
Sure. Well, a couple of things. My first suggestion always is to have more dogs, because then you can rotate them out, and you know where I'm going with that. But so I think that is an important part, though, is planned rest and working dogs and not leaving dogs down, you know, all day and wearing them out. And it is not just muscles, as you know. The feet are probably one of the most important things you see, especially if you're Western hunting, which tends to be a lot of these, you know, people decide they're going to go to South Dakota or Kansas or, you know, Oregon and hunt, and their dogs, A, they're not in shape, and B, their pads can't handle, you know, lava rock or all, you know, cactus and sagebrush. So I think just resting dogs intermediately, or maybe run them for 2 days and then give them a full day off to recover. Yeah. So that's one part. I think you can try and put more calories in the dog with maybe, you know, I like to add Fortiflora, especially when I'm on the road for a while. It helps keep their digestive system working properly, making sure they're utilizing all the nutrients that are going in there. And then feeding more. I mean, there's no question that you can bump up their feed a little bit when you're hunting to try and keep them going.
Yeah. I've got to thank you, and I wish I had done it sooner. Fortiflora, another Nestle Purina product. It's a probiotic, am I correct in that?
Yeah. Yep.
I always confuse the two. And it's a little packet, and you sprinkle it on, and you do all that. And it's done a couple other things for me. For my dog, I mean.
Yep.
I have yet to taste
it. Have you tried
it? And I'll tell you a funny story about that. But it is also, you know, we've all run into dogs that refuse to eat at the end of the day.
Yep.
Or refuse to drink.
Yes.
And you said something once offhand on the phone about topper on the food. Blah, blah. Then I said, yeah, he won't drink either. Try that. It works.
Isn't that funny?
It's
kind of one of the greatest, one of the weirdest things is, right, you think you go on a hunting trip and you're on the road and your dog works all day and you think, my God, they're going to eat like crazy. And then all of a sudden this dog that eats all the time at home, you're on the road, he needs the calories and he quits eating. It's like, what's up with this? So that Fortiflora, A, the probiotic is great for them, and B, it tastes good, and it doesn't have, like, you know, people will tell you, well, low-sodium chicken broth or whatever, and that's great, but it has sodium in it. So you can end up with more sodium than you need. So that's one of the great things about Fortiflora. Not only is it a palatability enhancer, it's a probiotic. And I think, too, warming the food sometimes, or warming the water, right, especially if you're on a hunting trip, that's something, when you warm water or warm a food, it gives off more odor and becomes more palatable, right? So
volatile esters. There,
thank you. Perfect. All right, doctor. Right on.
No, music major.
So.
Yeah. You know, okay, so I will tell you, because you'll get a kick out of it more than everybody else who has to listen to me tell this today. So way back, I was going to an outdoor writers convention and get to talking to the guy next to me, and turns out it's our mutual friend Arlie Reynolds.
Oh, right on.
And he's going down to the same thing to introduce that bar you guys made for we called it.
And, Refuel Bar. Yeah. Refuel Bar, yep.
And so they're making their presentation, and Bob West was there, another mutual friend from Purina. And I was a little bit more radical back then, I guess. So in the course of that discussion, they took questions from the audience, and I said, Arlie, have you tasted it yet?
Yep.
And he looked at Bob, and then they looked at me, and they said, next question. But it is a funny one, and I remember years ago in another career when everybody would tell us, oh, you know, the dog food company up the road there, they make dog food, they taste it every day.
Yep, yep.
So what does Fortiflora taste like?
I have no idea.
Okay, good. You know, but there is some truth to, I mean, if you can't put your nose up to this stuff, and if you're disgusted when you sniff your dog food or your whatever you're putting in your dog, that you probably ought not to give it to them.
Right.
So let's talk a little bit about performance, and you've been there. You mentioned a Nastra trial, and I came in not last at one of those
runs,
so I'm pretty happy with that. What are some of the things beyond feeding strategically?
Yep.
We're talking about hydration. We're talking about maybe some thing, other things in that world that we can put in a dog, put on a dog, yep, that will help them perform, whether it's a trial, long hunt,
yep,
long, boring day in the blind, whatever it is.
Well, you know, and I probably should have given you a little more information, too, about strategic. I think one of the important things is that, you know, a higher fat diet tends to have better long-term energy for the dog. They burn fat more efficiently than they burn carbohydrates.
Yeah.
Protein is really what fuels and builds their muscles. So I think the high-fat diet for extended exercise is the best thing for the dog. And, you know, there's an old rumor people would say, oh, you know, during the summer it's hot out, I don't want to feed a high-fat diet or a high-protein diet. I'm going to burn them up. It's too hot. Makes them hot. The reverse is actually true.
Wow.
They are not... They, because they burn fat more easily than they burn carbohydrates, it helps keep them running longer and cooler than on a high carbohydrate diet. So, you know, the argument to switch in the summer to a lower fat, lower protein diet really doesn't make sense. The only time I tell people that I would potentially change is if the dog is becoming very inactive, starting to gain weight, and you just have too many calories in your, like, 30-20 performance formula. Then, you know, you can cut back in the summer, but if you get to the point where the dog's gaining weight, they're getting, you know, a cup and a half a day, they look at you like, you know, you're starving them to death, then I think it makes sense. But the important thing is to switch back to a performance-based food probably 8 weeks before the season starts so that dog's system can get used to burning a high-fat diet again, kind of getting it primed metabolically for that fuel.
Yeah, I remember when Larry Mueller first told me that. Give it 60 days.
Yeah, yeah.
And he was pretty clear about doing that. But the biology, the physiology of that, I'm not quite sure about. Can you, without being a scientist about it, can you explain it to it?
Well, I'm neither a vet nor a scientist, but maybe I can say it in a way that everybody will understand, is that the dogs get better at processing the fat. You know, their body actually changes metabolically to process that better. They build up mitochondria, and it just kind of absorbs that fat better and burns it better. That's probably as good as I can do on it. I wish Dr. Ruth Ann was available here, but she's actually on the stage at the other end giving a presentation right now. But their systems are amazing. And maybe another way to think of it, and this is probably not medically correct, but you know how people go on Atkins diets and they get into what they call ketosis or whatever, where they're learning, you know, body's burning fats or different things. It's somewhat like that.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Not exactly from a process point, but just that our bodies are able to adapt to a diet to use it better.
Can we ever give a dog too much fat?
Yes. And I think the first thing about that is once you start adding fat, after a point, they have a hard time digesting it, and it's really easy to get their stools loose.
Yeah.
You know, there are some higher fat diets, and really, if you do switch to one of those diets, you got to give them some time to adjust to it. You know, some people will try and add a little corn oil or add fat into their diet to try and keep weight, and the key is doing it slowly. You know, and people talk about blowout and digestive upset. You very seldom get that going from a higher fat diet to a lower fat diet. You get it from going lower fat to higher fat. So you got to move slower to allow the body to adjust.
You know, one of the things that that always intrigues me is what some people will call low blood sugar.
Yeah.
In the field.
Yes.
There's some other things that are confused with that, and sometimes they're, you know, really dangerous things.
Yes. Yeah.
Can we do anything during the day to minimize the risk of things like that?
Yeah, that's a great question. And, you know, there is definitely hypoglycemia where issues happen with dogs. And not being a vet, I wouldn't want to comment too much on that. But knowing that once you've seen it and detected it, it is really good to go talk to a vet and get on a plan for when you see that dog starting to to go down or whatever, to know what type of sugar to administer and how to do it for them.
Yeah, you know, well, a lot of people say, oh, I bring, you know, those little packets of honey or I had
Karo syrup or something.
There's lots of little tricks out there, and, and they're probably all better than nothing.
Yes, and I've seen it, and it is scary. I mean, it's just a very unnerving thing. It's like when you have a dog that goes into a seizure for some reason. It's, you know, it's a very helpless feeling and hard to deal with, but, you know, they're pretty resilient animals, and most dogs, once you figure out and how to manage it, not overwork them. Again, we talked earlier about not working too long. You know, I last month I was fortunate to go hunting with Ronnie and Susanna and Steve Snell and Callie Parmley in West Texas, and it was hot. And they were very diligent about not leaving dogs on the ground for, you know, more than 20, 30 minutes. You know, really
Texas,
switching them out.
Yeah,
and, you know, fortunately we had a lot of dogs. We were able to do that. You know, if you just have one dog, you know, then I think it's you as the caregiver have to reel them in, say, hey, we're going to take a drink here. We're going to stop and slow down for a second, get that drink. You know, and a lot of people say, well, you know, my dog comes back and he won't drink.
Yeah.
It's like, well, just wait a minute then. You know, they'll drink eventually. You're giving in to them. You're the one that tells them when they can, you know, hit the field or got to hit the showers. Make them hit the showers for a little while and cool off, hydrate, and learn to drink. And, you know, we talked about the Fortiflora, and that's a great tip. If dogs don't like to drink, you know, putting a little Fortiflora in their water bottle, it tastes good. It does encourage them to drink.
Yeah, and I'm going to definitely be doing that this season for that reason. And the other, I really, this might be the best tip of the day, is this idea of just don't give him one chance to drink. Hold on to him for a little bit.
Yep.
I have a good friend who, he doesn't carry water bottles for the dog. He has a little collapsible bowl. Mm-hmm. And the real key to that is, number one, it forces him to stop.
Yep.
Take his pack off.
Yep.
Find the bowl. Find some water. Fill the bowl. Give it to the dog. This whole time, the dog is settling in.
Absolutely.
And changing their mind just a little bit. They're not eager anymore to race back out. And then she drinks.
100%. 100%. Yep. Yeah. I see it so often that people get impatient. The dog comes back. They try and dump a little water down their throat. The dog doesn't want to do it. And they, what the heck? They go.
Yeah.
You know, they can learn to drink. Yeah. And you can just take another minute, and all of a sudden that, you know, maybe that 4 minutes becomes 3 minutes, becomes 2 minutes, and then pretty soon you have a dog that learns to drink when they come back.
Yeah, just don't drink out of the same bowl as the one with the Fortiflora in it, everybody. Well, you know, we've covered a lot of ground, and I appreciate it because I learn something every time I talk with you. But if you were to, you know, put yourself in the shoes of a NASTRC competitor, mm-hmm. or a field trial guy, or even a, you know, a hunt test guy, it doesn't matter. What are some of the things that translate from that to the rest of us schlubs who are just walking around trying to find a bird in South Dakota sometime that pertain to dogs, dog health?
So I'm not sure if I'm tracking with you, but I'll tell you one thing that is interesting is dogs that are trained in short periods and all that. You go out there, you've put birds out, they know there's birds out there, they run out there, they find birds, and then you go hunting.
Yeah.
And then you go to wherever that maybe the populations are low this year, and those dogs, they expect to find something and be rewarded pretty quickly.
Yeah.
And they get, I guess, disappointed, or pretty quickly they get frustrated, they're not finding birds, and they kind of quit hunting.
They do. And they check out.
Yeah. And, you know, on the bird dog stage the other day, we were talking about how the dogs that kind of grew up in periods where there were a lot of birds to hunt end up becoming good bird finders, and the dogs that grew up in periods where there just were not a lot of birds never become as good a dog as they could be, because I don't think there's anything that's as good for a hunting dog as hunting, you know, finding birds in the wild.
Yep. Yeah, you know, it is the ultimate manure pile, you know, the child who's digging down on Christmas Day. Well, if there's this much manure, there must be a pony in the bottom.
Right.
You know,
right.
And Ronnie and Susanna had a great suggestion for that, and you've probably heard it, but I'm going to say it again because I'm going to remember this. If that dog as a young dog was trained to know that sometimes birds were out there because you showed them some of those birds.
Yep.
They're more motivated towards thinking or believing or somehow understanding that somewhere out there is that manure pile.
Yep.
And then I start digging.
Yes.
And it's not a perfect analogy, but it is funny.
Yeah.
How about just dogs in general and hunting with dogs? You've done it a million times.
Yep.
Last lesson for the rest of us?
Boy, one of the best tips I heard a few years ago was from Tom Dokken, and I've always believed in it, but I'd never heard it put so well, and it was the idea of when you go and get to where you're hunting, the last thing you take out of the truck before you start hunting is the dog, and when you get back to the truck, the first thing you put back in the truck is the dog.
Yeah.
Because so often, you know, the truck, you got there, so you drove on a road, and you might be by a road, especially like if you're in, you know, the big woods in Minnesota or something, you know, you park a little parking area right off of a small highway, and you're excited, but the dog's excited, so you let the dog out, and then you got to get your shotgun and put on your vest, and you do all that, and you're thinking, hey, I'm going to let the dog air out and burn some steam and all that. But in the meantime, you're not paying attention, and then the dog has the possibility of being run over, and just the same in reverse when you get back. So that's, to me, even though it's been said a million times, I still think it's the best tip, and I'm always shocked when I go hunting with somebody new or whatever, and they get there and the first thing they do is cut the dog out, and it's like, wait a minute.
Yeah.
I guess the rest of the world doesn't know that yet. So, well, I'm going to keep preaching it.
Good.
Till, you know, because there's nothing worse than a dog getting injured on a hunt. And some things are unpreventable. You know, accidents happen, but a lot of them are preventable.
Yeah, thanks, Tom. You reminded me of that, too, and I think I've written about it once or twice. The worst problem with that situation, though, is when you finally do shut the tailgate and you got the vest on, you're shucking shells in, and the dog's on point 400 yards away.
Right. That's good troubles.
Yeah. If only we could have those all the time.
Yeah.
Carl Gunzer is with Purina. He's my go-to guy when it comes to advice on feeding and dog nutrition and performance. I'm Scott Linden. This is the Upland Nation podcast from the floor of the Sioux Falls Convention Center at the Pheasant Fest and Quail Classic. Carl, I couldn't think of a better guy to talk to on the last day of the show. Thanks so much for being a part of the Upland Nation podcast.
Well, thanks. And one of these days, instead of a podcast, we're going to get together in the field and chase some birds behind a good bird dog.
I'm ready anytime for you. Call me.
Right on.
Oh, that was a lot of fun. Every time I go to Pheasant Fest, I think I try to recruit other people to go for the first time. And, you know, that the last one was no exception. Sioux Falls, South Dakota really rolled out the red carpet, and everybody was as upbeat as I've ever seen them. And I'm going on my 15th or 16th Pheasant Fest. Thank you, everybody at Pheasants Forever and Quail Forever, for all your hard work. Keep up that. It's really good. And that part of the show brought to you by MidwayUSA.com. Carries just about everything for shooting, hunting, and the outdoors. Lots of camping stuff if that's your bag this time of year. Sign up for emails or text notifications and you'll get 10% off your next order. I'm shopping for a youth shotgun right now. Long story. No, not for one of my kids or their kids. I am. It really is. But anyway, this is youth Shotgun Central. Over 35 different varieties of youth shotguns in stock and ready for your young shooter. Yeah, you buy it from Midway, they'll send it to your FFL. Simple. They'll even reach out to the FFL and take care of all of that for you. That's why they have such a great customer service rating. It's their number one goal. Customer satisfaction is what they do best. Learn more at MidwayUSA.com. And take care of your gun, no matter whose shotgun you bought or whose size it is, with SageAndBreaker.com. Gun cleaning and care crafted at the highest caliber. Yeah, if you want to take care of your gun the right way, take a look at SageAndBreaker.com. They make high-quality, heirloom-quality gun cleaning products and accessories. They've got a little bit of everything. Shop around over there. Sign up for the mailing list. You don't want to miss out on future sales. Father's Day's coming up. Yeah, send that link to your whoever purchases a Father's Day gift for you. There's something there for everybody at every budget size. Learn more at sageandbreaker.com. This week on the Handle It segment, well, we're going a little bit further afield for a lot of us, and that is a question from Facebook. Jasper Brand asked this one, and I thought it would be fun as an exercise, if nothing else, to help him out just a little bit. Of course, if you want to help him out a lot more, then go to the Facebook pages and put your suggestions in the comments section. Jasper asks, how am I going to keep my flushing dog in range, if you will, so that you can actually get a realistic shot? I'm presuming that's what you mean, Jasper. At least that's how I'm going to answer it. I'm not an expert, but I have worked with a lot of experts in this field. One of my favorites, of course, Al Guidori over in Montana. old timers and pro trainers have a few go-to strategies to keep your dog in close. And it's the kind of the corollary to my biggest agony when I had my first wire hair. It was so bad, I actually went to my wire hair guru and told him, my dog, he's ranging way out there, 120, 140 yards that way, and then he's coming back the other way, 140. Of course, we all know 140 yards in chukar country is nothing. But I was freaked out. And I said, why is he way out there? My friend Bill Lowe at the time said, because there are no birds closer to him. So he's looking for birds. So is your flushing dog. If there are no birds closer and he hasn't been trained enough to expect birds to be closer, then he's going to range. Problem solved, right? Not really. Unless you live in a place that is just chock full of birds that are close into the route you're taking. And that might work, you know, on a great grouse hunt or an excellent bobwhite hunt somewhere in the middle of the season. But what about training season? Well, you got to get your own birds and you got to simulate that. One way to do it, not the only way, and everybody else has some other suggestions, I'm sure, is to have a helper and have that helper walk at what you want to be the edge of, quote, gun range, unquote. That helper is a little bit ahead of you, and he's dropping birds on the ground at that maximum gun range, or even closer. I'll talk about that someday as well. But the idea being, that way your young dog, or even your more experienced dog, is reminded that, yes, there are birds close in. I don't have to range way out there, because I know they're close in. I find them when he drops them. Or I find them, I didn't see him drop them. Even better. So you're just training like you're training everything else. You want to create a habit with your dog, Jasper, that is built around the expectation that there are birds close in. I just have to work at it. I just have to stay in close to find them. Hopefully, that will help you a little bit. Repeat, repeat, repeat. Yeah, I know it's a lot of birds, but you want a great bird dog? You better have birds. Good luck, Jasper, and thank you all, everybody, for your own answers and suggestions on that one as well. You want to get involved in that or ask a question that we can all pitch in on? Just go to one of the social media pages. Just ask it. It might end up right here on the Upland Nation podcast. And Handle It this week is brought to you by ESPAmerica.com. Hit the target. Save your hearing. Yeah, these guys make custom-fit digital hearing protection for everybody. And by everybody, I mean, yeah, it's custom-fit. Your ears alone. And the custom-fitting is part of the reason they are so effective at protecting your hearing. Nothing, literally nothing else can fit in there. It's all translated through the microphone, and that's why it works so well. They've been making custom-fitted electronic hearing protection since 1994. These guys have figured it out. They got the best technology and the best design to deliver the best possible hearing protection. Learn more at espamerica.com. Yeah, and then if you need an excuse to test them out, get yourself a new shotgun from Mid Valley Clays and Shooting School. Yeah, they're hunters. They know what works on the range or in the field, and they stock a big assortment of sub-gauges. Yeah, I'm getting kind of partial to that 28, but I've also got a 20, and I've got a 410 in the safe that I probably ought to break out just to see how it's working. Anyway, Dave Fiedler can help you with all of that. Dave is the guy I ask all the dumb questions of when I'm looking for a new shotgun, and so can you. No obligation. Just go to midvalleyclays.com, get the phone number, and talk to Dave Fiedler. He knows what works. He knows why it works. Every single shotgun style configuration on the market. So start there and then make a more informed decision when you're buying your own next shotgun. midvalleyclays.com. Well, I sure appreciate your listening. I appreciate everybody who has done their bit and helped other hunters become better based on the comments and suggestions in our social media. Good job, everybody. I appreciate those who leave ratings and reviews. And of course, thank you to our sponsors, Sage and Breaker, Purina Pro Plan Sport, ESP America, Mid Valley Clays, TruLock Chokes, MidwayUSA.com, LandTrust.com, and Hi-Viz Shooting Systems. We're always talking, and there's always something new at my homepage, FindBirdHuntingSpots.com. Looking forward to chatting with you there and on all the social media. I'm Scott Linden. Thanks for listening to the Upland Nation Podcast.